Let's go ahead and open up to Romans 3. Romans 3, and we're at a really critical juncture in Romans 3. This is kind of a difficult point for me because the first 2.5 chapters, I think, are critical to our understanding. Usually, they're run through pretty quick. Even a lot of grace pastors I have had have run through them pretty quick. And hopefully, over the last 2 years or so, not quite 2 years, it'll be a couple more months, it'll be 2 years, you'll see why I've spent extra time in Romans 1 through the first half of Romans 3. We're going to finish off the first half of Romans 3 today, hopefully. But I just wanted to bring out this point that those first 2.5 chapters are critical. I don't know if anyone remembers, but 2 years ago when I started teaching Romans, I said that, and I still firmly believe that if we go right in Romans, we'll pretty much be going right. We'll at least be heading the right direction through the rest of his Romans and the rest of his epistles. But if we go wrong in Romans 1, then we're going to be going wrong everywhere after that. And that's why I thought it was worthwhile to spend some extra time in Romans 1 and 2, because most pastors, most of the time when you teach it, you know, if you just go by what historic Christianity says, what most commentators say, they say Romans 1, the first half of Romans 1 is basically a greeting. You know, what do we think of greetings and introductions? There's things to be gone through. There's not a lot going on in them. They kind of want to rush you ahead, and they'll spend a little time in verses 16 and 17, and they'll call that the theme of the chapter, or the theme of the book about the righteousness of God. And then they get into man's sinfulness and the worthiness of the wrath of God. You know, who likes to spend a lot of time in that section? So they kind of rush through the second chapter and half of the third chapter or three, and they want to get over to Romans 3:21, where all the good stuff starts and where Paul's really starting Romans. I've tried to slow us down and back us all up, because if we approach Romans like that, we're conceding too much to historic Christianity, who's apostatized from Paul's truth, from God's truth through the Apostle Paul, and it began in the days of Paul himself. And so it's no wonder it's still going on today. So hopefully, what we saw there is that the first half of Romans 1 isn't just a greeting introduction. It's not just Paul fulfilling the letter writing etiquette of his day, or some commentators say he's buttering them up and flattering them so they'll be more receptive to his message. None of that. It's God's proclamation and declaration that he's raised up this new and distinct apostle and gave him this new and distinct apostleship. And now maybe there's some who are thinking, I'm just clubbing us over the head with Paul's distinctive apostleship. And if there's anyone who's thinking that, I'm glad you're thinking that, because that's what I've been trying to do. Because that's the actual doctrine that most people throw away. Historic Christianity is thrown away. They don't see it here. And when we remember that Romans is written to believers, he's not trying to convert them to Christianity. They're already believers through his ministry indirectly, through his co-workers. They've already been saved. He's writing Romans now to tell them how to live the Christian life. And that's critically important, because what we have to see when we come to the Word and we understand Paul's distinctive apostleship, what we need to see in Romans is that when God is beginning to explain the basis of the Christian life, he doesn't start over in 3:21 with justification by grace through faith. He doesn't start in Romans, last half of Romans 1 and 2 with man's sinfulness and wrathworthiness. The very first thing that we need to know, we need to appreciate, we need to understand, according to God, because he opens up Romans with it, is the distinctive apostleship of Paul. That's the first step to successful Christian living, to walking in a way that's well-pleasing him, to conducting our lives in a way according to our calling, he says at one time. If you throw away Paul's distinctive apostleship, you don't know what your calling is. You're going to mix it up with Israel's calling and other people's callings in the Bibles. You're not going to know. So how can you walk worthy to a calling when you don't even know what it is? And, you know, I've been to a lot of grace assemblies. I've been to a lot of grace conventions. And even grace teachers and pastors and grace believers sometimes diminish this truth. They say, well, it's kind of a secondary truth. As long as they're saved by grace through faith, that's the important thing. And then they think, you know, and if they grasp Paul's distinctive apostleship, all the better. But if not, that's okay too. They're still believers. And they kind of throw in the towel. But when God goes to describing how to live the Christian life down here on earth, on planet earth, on a sin-cursed territory under enemy control, he says the very first thing he covers in the first half of Romans 1, before he talks about anything else, is the distinctiveness of Paul's apostleship. And so I've got that club in my hand one more time, where I'm going to use club us one more time, and then I'm putting away the club when we get over into Romans 3:21, the club of Paul's distinctive apostleship. We're going to look at one thing. And if you also remember when I started this teaching way back almost 2 years ago, my ministry, I have an internet ministry, and I started that because I didn't want other people to have the same journey I had to take. I grew up in a Grace Assembly. I knew what was right. I mean, I knew water baptism wasn't for today. I knew the sign gifts had ceased. I knew that we're under grace, not under law. I knew all that. I knew what was right and wrong, but I didn't know why. And you see, if you only know what's right and wrong, now that's good, don't get me wrong, that's a good start. But if you only know what's right and wrong, then you're going to have to be dependent on human teachers, because you're going to have to go to someone who's telling you these things. The key is that, the problem is that human teachers come and go. And that's what happened to me. I grew up in a Grace Assembly, probably 10 years of that Grace Assembly, and with a Grace teacher, I learned all these things. I had a wonderful time there. My whole life revolved around. I didn't even know anything else existed. I thought all churches taught this. And then I go to Champaign-Urbana off to college, and what's the first thing I do? I looked, well, maybe not the first thing. One of the first things I did was look in the Yellow Pages. Do any of the young people here know what Yellow Pages are anymore? And I looked for churches, and there was Urbana Bible Church. I was like, smooth sailing, no problem. Go to Urbana. My Grace Church was called the Bible Church. And I was so naive, I thought all Bible churches taught what my Bible church taught. And I went there, and believe me, they didn't teach what my Bible church taught. And then I thought I'd straighten everything up and go talk to my old Bible teacher when I got back home in the summer. And I got back home in the summer, and that Grace pastor was gone. That church had divided, had split, had vanished. And what happened then is I just felt like a flag in the wind, just fluttering around. I knew what, at least some of the what's of what was right and wrong, but I didn't know why. And once my Grace pastor was gone, once that Grace Assembly was gone, I didn't know why. And it actually took me years to get back on track. And that's my ministry. If I can help anyone not have to do that, go through that journey, that's really what my ministry is. So I'm going to pick up the club of Paul's distinctive apostleship one more time, and then I'm going to put it away. So if you don't run out screaming, if you're sick of hearing it, it's just one more time, and this is especially for the young people in the assembly. I'm going to lay out here some of the most fundamental and basic things about Paul's distinctive apostleship, and they're really simple. They're really easy. You don't have to go to a seminary. You don't have to get a master's in divinity. You don't have to get a PhD. You don't have to do any of that. They're very simple things, the distinctions that God makes in his word, and we should make in our understanding of his word. So let's take a look at it. Here's a chart, and we're going to kind of just go through this. When we think of Paul's distinctive apostleship, here are the major things we're saying are the distinctions. And especially for the young people here, if you have a basic understanding of these four or five things, five things here, you'll understand why everyone else is teaching things that don't sound right, that things that God isn't doing today. And this is the reason why. If we open up, the first and biggest distinction is God's two purposes. See, now, if you throw away Paul's distinctive apostleship, as most of historic Christianity has done, who apostatized from Paul's distinctive apostleship in the very days of Paul, if you throw that away, you're going to say there's only one purpose of God in the Bible. And you're going to say that's revealing, they call it redempto, historical purpose, and that's the one main thing going through the Bible. But the problem with that man-centered theology is that it starts in Genesis 3, but the Bible doesn't start in Genesis 3. The Bible starts in Genesis 1:1 with the creation of the heaven and the earth. And we know both of those realms have fallen. The heavenlies have fallen through the angelic rebellion, and earth has fallen, that carried down to earth, and then earth fell with human rebellion, sin and rebellion. So there's two purposes of God. One is to restore his glory on earth, and the other is to restore or reestablish his glory in the heavenlies. Those are God's purposes. If you throw away Paul's apostleship, you're left with a man-centered theology. But we want to stay with a God-centered theology. God's primary purpose is reestablishing his glory in the heavenlies and on earth. And in the process, he does the secondary thing of providing redemption for us, because he's going to use us to do that. But God's primary thing in the Bible is not our redemption. And I don't mean to minimize that or diminish that one bit. That's extremely important. It's infinitely glorious. It's wonderful. But God's primary purpose is his glory, reestablishing his glory on earth, reestablishing his glory in the heavenlies. He's going to do it through two programs. First is the prophetic program, and that's described as having been spoken about since the world began. And then Paul comes on the scene, and guess how he describes his preaching? He describes his preaching as mystery program, mystery truth, a mystery program, and he describes it as something kept secret since the world began. Something that has been spoken about, something made known since the world began, can't be the same thing as something kept secret since the world began. And, you know, historic Christianity has toyed around with that in so many ways. They've tried to say, well, it's hidden in the Old Testament and those types and all the other things that they come up in the parables of Jesus and the types and shadows of the Old Testament. All that. But Paul explicitly says no to that. He explicitly says in Ephesians 3 that it wasn't hidden in the Old Testament. It was hid in God from eternity past. It's hidden God until he revealed it to and through the Apostle Paul. So you have the two purposes, the two programs, the prophetic program, which he's going to use to restore his glory on earth, and the mystery program, kept secret since the world began, that he's going to restore his glory in the heavenlies. God's two people. Now, how is he going to do this? Who's he going to use to do this? He's going to take the prophetic program, he's going to use the nation of Israel, and he's going to use them to implement his prophetic program to reestablish his glory on earth. Paul comes on the scene and he says God has now set aside the nation of Israel temporarily, and he's now doing a new work in creating and calling out unto himself the body of Christ, and it's through them that he's going to carry out his mystery program, which will reestablish his glory in the heavenlies. And you see, who would have ever thought of it? Do you see why God kept it a secret? This is why Paul said to the Corinthians, why God kept it a secret, because no one would ever think of this on their own. Who would ever think of a redeemed humanity? Everyone can understand a redeemed humanity doing something on earth, because we're earthly, right? We belong on earth. We're here on earth. But who would have ever thought God was going to redeem a group of fallen humanity and call them out into the body of Christ and then seat them in the heavenlies? See, no one would have thought of that. And Paul explicitly tells the Corinthians the reason God kept this a secret, because if the powers of darkness knew, they wouldn't have crucified the Lord. So we have God's two people. The nation of Israel is what God uses in the prophetic program to restore his glory on earth. And the body of Christ is what God's going to use to carry out his mystery program to restore his glory in the heavenlies. God's two operational systems. For Israel and her prophetic program, he has the operational system of the law works flesh system. And for Paul, when he comes on the scene, he describes now we're not under law, we're under grace. And the idea there isn't that there's no laws, no commands, no instructions in the grace system, and there's no grace in the law system. That's not the issue. There's both and both. But the issue is that how God is dealing with humanity is the system of law and a system based on grace. And the body of Christ is under the operational system of a grace, faith, spirit system. And then God's two methods of blessing. Everything else written in the Old Testament, in the Gospels, in the ministry of Peter and the 12 and early Acts, and of course then in their epistles, their, what are typically called the general epistles, everything has to do with God blessing the world with Israel and through her rise. Paul comes on the scene and he says, now God's blessing the world apart from Israel and through her fall. And those are the main distinctive components, I guess you'd call them, of Paul's distinctive apostleship. And if you have an understanding of that, and you can keep that in your mind, it's going to keep you so much more grounded and edified and established when you go out in the world and when you interact with your friends and relatives and why you're going to wonder why they're doing these things and why they're getting off on these going off on these different tangents, you'll know why. To the degree you throw away Paul's distinctive apostleship is the degree to which you're leaving God. When you leave God and what he's doing, you're going to substitute it with your own thoughts. And they're going to be the vain imaginations of man. And then that's why there's thousands of different sects, hundreds of different denominations, tens of different so-called Christian religions, and a church on every street corner, and they're all saying something different. And the reason they're saying something different is because, for the most part, they've thrown away Paul's distinctive apostleship. Paul's distinctive apostleship adds like a controlling factor that prevents the vain imaginations of men from entering into what God's doing today. And so I just thought I'd do that. That's my last clubbing with the distinctiveness of Paul's apostleship. I'm going to throw the club away, and we're going to go on, and we're going to finish the first half of Romans 3. That's my conclusion to the first 2.5 chapters or so, and hopefully, especially the young people, as they go out into the world, and especially if you've always been involved in a grace assembly, you may not even realize the kind of things that are out there in the world. And now, hopefully, this will serve as a basis when you ever have to ask not just what God's doing today or what's right or wrong, but why it's right or wrong. All right, we're going to go to Romans 3, and I'm just going to read these. We've covered these over the last weeks. And we're just to kind of give a little background, in Romans 1, God announces Paul's distinctive apostleship and gives those two patterns. The first half of Romans 1, he gives God's way to righteousness and life, and he uses Paul's ministry as the pattern in those first 17 verses. In the last half of Romans 1, he gives man's way to sin and death based on the pattern of fallen humanity. Romans 2, he explains that no one, Jew and Gentile alike, can escape God's wrath by holding as having no value, or what our King James says there, despising the riches of God now being dispensed through Paul's apostleship. And we looked into that, that Paul describes his whole apostleship as now God dispensing his riches to the world. And the only thing, if you throw away what God's dispensing through Paul's apostleship, the riches of God, there's a play on words in those few verses. The only thing you're getting rich in is wrath under the day of wrath. Then in the last few weeks, we've seen in Romans 3 that it opens by explaining that no one, especially the Jew, can escape God's wrath by attacking the messenger, attacking the apostleship of Paul. It just proves that their condemnation is just. And beginning in Romans 3, we have it like these, especially from the Jewish perspective, where he says, well, Paul, if what you're saying is true, if your apostleship is real, if God has cast away Israel, God has set them aside, if it's because of their unbelief that God's now doing this thing among the Gentiles, if all that's what you're saying now is true, then everything you're saying springs from the principle of let us do evil that good may come. And Paul says, your condemnation is just. Because that's, of course, not what Paul's saying. What Paul is saying, though, is that in the midst of sinfulness, in the midst of our unbelief, in the midst of our unrighteousness, in the midst of our unfaithfulness, in the midst of our untruthfulness and falsehood, in the midst of all that, God is holding back his wrath and judgment a little while longer and is now injecting into that lost situation his grace, peace, and mercy. Then we can begin in Romans 3:10 with that background. What then? Are we better than they? Remember this whole context here of the Jews. He's shown they have advantage. God has given them the oracles, but the oracles would only be an advantage if they believed him and were faithful to them. And he's demonstrated over and over in many different ways that they haven't believed them and they haven't been faithful to them. What then? Are we better than they? No, in no wise. For we have proved, both Jews and Gentiles, that they are all under sin. All under sin. Now, why does God do that? Why does God place all under sin? A lot of times I talk to people about this, and what would they say? A lot of times their first thing is because he's unfair. He's unjust. Why should I be in the same category as someone else? Why should he put me in the same category as the guy in the jail or the guy I heard on the news last night or whatever? Is he unjust? Is he unfair? Is he just mean? Is he just looking for someone to club? So I thought we'd look at why God has concluded all and unrighteousness. You can keep a finger here and go over to Romans 11. Romans 11:32. And of course, this comes at the end, right before his concluding remarks about this mystery truth he's been revealed, this whole mystery program that God has revealed to and through the Apostle Paul. And look at verse 32. For God hath concluded them all in unbelief. In Romans 3, he says he's concluded them all under sin. He's concluded them all in unbelief. Why? Because he's mean? Because he's not loving? Because he's unjust? No, because so that he might have mercy on all. Let's see how that works. Flip over to Galatians 3. Galatians 3, and we'll see him say something very similar with a little more explanation. Verse 22. But the scripture hath concluded all under sin, that the promise by faith of Jesus Christ might be given to them that believe. That the promise of the faith of Christ Jesus, the faithfulness of Christ, the person and work in Christ, the cross work of Christ might be made available and given to all who believe. That's why he's gathered everyone together under sin, so that he's put them all in the sphere of unrighteousness, he's put them all in the sphere under power of sin, so that he can move them over to the power of God, to the sphere of righteousness for all who believe. And what does it mean when we talk about being under the power of sin? Usually I'll come up with my own notes and then I'll go read some of my favorite commentators. A lot of them say something kind of unusual here. They say this is the first time that the word sin has been used since the beginning of the book. Can anyone think of whether that's true or not? How many think that's true? Raise your hand. No, good. It's not true. So don't think it is. Because go back a page to Romans 2, and he does talk about it. Now, in Romans 2, it's the verb. In Romans 3, it's the noun. But I still would kind of consider them the same word. Look at verse 12, chapter 2, verse 12. For as many as have sinned without law shall also perish without law. And as many have sinned in the law shall be judged by the law. See, man's ultimate problem is not that they commit sins. That's just a symptom of the problem. Man's ultimate problem is that they're under sin. They're under the power of sin. They're under sin's control. They're under mastership of sin. And when did that happen? Remember in Romans 1, the last half of Romans 1, he's talking about they rebelled against God. They declared their independence from God. and they thought they were being wise. Remember back in Romans 1, they said, we're going to declare our independence from God, and that is going to demonstrate our wisdom. We're so wise to do that, because you know what mankind thought? Mankind thought that if they declared their independence from God, they would become gods, their own little gods. They would be independent. They'd be their own little gods. They'd have their own themselves only. They'd be independent, and they'd be their own gods. But what does Paul say that at that time when mankind thought he had reached the pinnacle of his wisdom in declaring his independence from God, God, through Paul, reveals they were just showing how utterly foolish they were. Because when they declared their independence from God, it didn't result in them becoming independent. They were just handed over to another master. They were just given up to another master, master sin and master death. And the utter foolishness of humanity in declaring their independence from God, thinking that would make them independent, all that happened, they were handed over to another master, master sin and master death. And that is what he's talking about when the sin concept is not so much we commit sins. The issue is that we're born under the enslavement to sin. We're under the power of sin. And we're back at chapter 3, verse 9. We have before proved both Jew and Gentile alike that they are all under sin. And so we saw in Romans 11:32, he concludes all under sin so that he can extend mercy to all and that he can save all who believe. Save all who believe. All right, let's look at Romans 3:10. But let's just work our way down through here, all under sin, and now he gives this whole list of sins and characteristics of sin. And just keep that in your mind. We have a list going on here, and start thinking back in Romans, in the first 2.5 chapters of Romans, if there was another time when God had given us a list. And just keep that in your back of your mind. We're going to end up there a little bit later. But let's look at verse 3, verse 10. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understand. There is none that seeketh after God. They are all gone out of the way. They are together become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good. No, not one. And now we have God, like, you know, and I just humorously say, I know God doesn't need x-ray glasses, but let's just use that kind of idea. He puts his x-ray glasses on, and he's looking down, and he's scanning every single person, and he's not looking at it. He's looking right at the heart, and he's scanning, and he's looking, and he's looking, and he's scanning, and he lifts his head up, and he says, there is none righteous. None. No, not one. He puts his head down again, and he looks. Now he looks, he was looking at the hearts. Now he's looking at the minds and the thinking, and he goes and he looks at everyone's mind and their thinking and their inner being, and he raises his head again and says, there's none that understand. There's none that understands. Then he looks down again, and he's looking, and he's looking where they're going, and he's looking at their feet, and he's watching where they're heading, and he's looking, he's checking out every single person to make sure he doesn't miss anyone, and he looks low up his head, and he said, there's none that seeketh after me. They've all gone out of the way. God's going this way, they're all going that way. There's none. They've all gone out of the way. They are altogether become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good. No, not one. And you see, that takes us back, if you remember from Romans 2, where he talks about how he's going to judge and put place, and that everybody's under his wrath, and the judgment that's going to be there. God isn't going to be looking at the external things. He's going to be looking at the internal things. He's going to be judging the works of men, not by looking at the works, but by looking where they came from. And if they came out of the plant of sin, out of the production line of sin, and they were produced on an assembly line contaminated with death, and it came from people associated with that plant, then everything that plant produces 24/7, all day long, all night long, and any time in between, all that plant can produce is things worthy of condemnation and assigned to destruction, tribulation and anguish, wrath and judgment. Remember we talked there about that blue bunny ice cream with the Listeria scare? Does anyone remember when we used that as an example? And there, you know, the health department didn't go and check every quart of ice cream. All they needed to know is where, what assembly line or what production line or what plant that ice cream came out of. All they looked at was the plant. They didn't care about the ice cream. Millions of people ate that ice cream, and if you asked most of them, they would say the ice cream was good. But there was 10 people, or was it 12, 10 or 12 people that got sick, and 5 or 6 of them died, and it didn't matter to the health department. Everything out of that production line was condemned for destruction. It didn't matter. They weren't even looking at the ice cream. They were only looking at where that ice cream came from. And the same thing is true with fallen humanity. That's what Paul says in Romans 8. The flesh can't do anything that pleases God. The problem with humanity is they think they can do something pleasing to God. They just don't. And that's what most of Christianity would even say. They need to try harder. They need to try to get themselves to do it. But Paul comes along and says, they can't do anything good. It's beyond their ability. And why? It's not because they need to do more good works and less bad works. The point is, they can't do any good works as long as they're associated with the plant of sin that's contaminated with death. Everything that comes off that, no matter what the ice cream looked like on the outside, it may have looked good, but God proclaims it condemned and sent for destruction. The only work that God accepts is the work produced by those associated with the factory of God, that's running on the power of God, that's been cleansed with the blood of Christ, that's been sanctified by the Holy Spirit, whose company policy and motive for being is the love of God at the cross of Christ. Only works that come out of that factory, that's produced by people associated with that factory, are works that God will accept, because that factory 24/7 produces love, hope, incorruptibility, immutability, glory and honor, all those things associated with Christ. And that's why humanity, in its fallen state, it's not the problem isn't they need to do more good works to be good enough for God. The problem is they can't do anything pleasing to God because they're under the power of sin, is what it says in 3:9. They're associated with the plant, the factory of sin and death. There is none that understand. There is none that seeketh after God. They've all gone out of the way, altogether unprofitable. They can't do anything that pleases God. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. None, because they're under the power of sin, and they're associated with the plan of sin and death, the factory of sin and death. And I've kind of put these together. We won't go over to Psalm 14. These are actual quotes. All these are quotes from Old Testament passages. This is from Psalm 14, 2 and 3. And you can go back and look at that on your own. But here I just want to bring out the kind of how I've grouped this together. Man's sin against and separation from God. The main gist in these couple of verses is man's rebellion against God. God's looking down. There's nobody righteous before him. They're all fleeing from him. Nobody's in his way. Nobody's seeking him. Everybody's going their own way and unprofitable and no good. All right, let's look at verse 13 now. Their throat is an open sepulcher. With their tongues they have used deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Now, I know it's a Sunday morning, and we don't want to think about this, but just, you know, think of a little bit of heartburn here, and that's that bitterness, that bile. When he's talking about bitterness here, it's that inside, what's true on the inside starts to come out on the outside. That bile, that bitterness, that bitter heart. We might, you know, the King James would call it the bowels, the inside. We might just lump it all under that heart concept. But man's problem is that from the very inside, it's not that they don't do enough external good things. The problem is that their insides are vile. Their insides are bitter, and that brings out, that goes into their throat metaphorically. It makes it a sepulcher. And with their tongues, they have used deceit. and the poison of asses under their lips. And, you know, it's like, imagine fangs under your lips, and they're just out to get to inject their poison into others and other things. And, you know, if you have any problem understanding those two verses, just turn the news on tonight, and it'll all become crystal clear. Because with what's going on in our political system and everything now, if you don't know what vileness of speech and deceit and all those things are, you know, just watch the news, and you'll be pretty much, you know exactly what they're talking about here. But this isn't anything new. This goes back all the way back. It's something true of fallen humanity, their cursing and their bitterness. Let's look at verse. So I would put this one under the category, man's sin against and separation from self and others through speech. This attack on others through words, and in our internet age, it's just magnified probably billionfold on this attack and this vileness of speech and usage of words. Look at verse 15 now. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways, and the way of peace have they not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Their feet are swift to shed blood, and they talk about this destruction are in their ways, everything they're doing. Now he's looking at the feet, and they're seeing everybody's marching just to, you know, trample people underfoot. Everybody's doing their own thing, and if they have to trample someone underfoot to get there, to climb the ladder of success, they're all looking for their own fame or their own fortune or their own personal gain, and they're using others for their own use. It's a characteristic of fallen humanity. And I put this, and Lana put this as a category of man's sin against and separation from self and others through his actions. Through his actions. And then it closes with verse 18. It's kind of this section. There is no fear of God before their eyes. It's kind of like a summary statement. There's no fear of God before their eyes. Now we know that what things soever the law saith, it saith to them who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God. And what he's saying there is, these are all quotes from the Jewish scriptures, the Israel scriptures, those oracles he talked about at the beginning of Romans 3. They're all quotes from those oracles. What was written in those oracles were written to the Jews, to Israel. Even the things that had to do with the Gentiles, they were still written to Israel. And he's saying here, foremost, what's written in those oracles are for the Jews. And then they apply to others as an extension of that. And he's driving home this point here. See, the Jews would have no problem understanding the Gentiles are under sin. They'd have no problem understanding. Of course, the Gentiles are under sin. Where the Jewish problem comes in is they might think they're an exception to being under sin. God's given them these advantages. God's using them. God's doing all this stuff with them. And they aren't under sin. But Paul now brings everything together, proves through this list of Old Testament scriptures from the Psalms and from Isaiah 59, and he drives home this point that what is spoken in those scriptures are first of all to the Jews, and as they apply to the Jews, you can be assured they apply to the rest of the world as well. Therefore, verse 20, therefore by the deeds of the law there shall no flesh be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. And we're going to pick that up in more detail next week and go on into verse 21. But here I just want to bring out the point. He's referring this all to Israel because the logic he's using here, if it applies to Israel and the Jews, it certainly applies to the Gentiles. If it's even true of the Jews, then it has to be true of the Gentiles. If the law given to Israel couldn't in any manner, way, or justify a Jew, then no work, nothing that a Gentile is going to come up with is going to work either. In showing that even the Jews are under sin, even Israel and the Jews are under sin, demonstrates that the whole world is under sin. Because if even the Jew with all their advantages is under sin, then of course the Gentiles are in the same predicament as that. You know, it reminds me of, I think it was Vernon McGee. Does anyone listen to Vernon McGee ever? I haven't heard him in a long time, but he's got that voice that you can't really forget. And he said one time, it's like growing pineapples in Canada. It doesn't work. Israel had all these advantages from God and all these things, all these advantages he's listed out already here. And we see again in Romans 9, those covenants and those grace covenants, those promises, the law and that sacrificial system. And of course, they're most importantly, Christ. Those oracles were concerning Christ. Vernon McGee gave the illustration that he, in spite of all those opportunities and in spite of those perfect conditions, Israel still couldn't grow a pineapple. Just like Canada wouldn't be able to. You could go to Canada and plant a pineapple and you could hoe it and you can weed it and you can water it and you're not going to get a pineapple. Pineapples don't grow in Canada. And I'm going to add a part B to that story. Because I was flipping through a channel on the Food Network. And, you know, England is pretty much like Canada, right, weather-wise. And it turned out they had this show on, and it was called Lords and Ladles or something. And what they do, I guess it was Ireland, not England. And what they do, they'd go to these old castles. And they would then kind of reproduce a meal at one of these castles and have the party like they would have had in the 1700s and 1800s. And one of these castles, believe it or not, had this huge green, multi-acre greenhouse. It wasn't still being used today, but back then, and guess what they grew in that greenhouse? They grew pineapples. So I thought Vernon McGee's story kind of breaks down here, but if we leave the greenhouse out, naturally speaking, you can't grow pineapples in Ireland or Canada. And the point is he was making is you can't produce righteous, even Israel, under her perfect conditions and with all the advantages she had and all, she couldn't grow righteousness on her own. She couldn't fulfill the law. She couldn't do the law. It's not possible for man to do it. And if it's true for the Jew that the works of the law couldn't save him, it's definitely true for the Gentile, whatever works he may think can't save him either. And we kind of reach the end of this section, as we go into Romans 3:21, man can do nothing that's acceptable to God. All right, so now, when you view these things, and keeping in mind where we've been before, does anyone going to throw out where we've had a list of sins before already in Romans? Romans 1, right? The end of Romans 1. So we're going to flip back a couple pages. This is the slide, if you haven't gotten the notes, you might want to, because I had to cram a lot in here. But my point in this slide is to show you that this ties in perfectly with the last half of Romans 1. Look how Romans 3 opens up. Look at Romans, the beginning of Romans 3. What advantage then hath the Jew? What profit is there of circumcision? Much every way. Chiefly because unto them were committed the oracles of God. What's this saying? That God has made himself known to Israel through his oracles. Keep your finger here and go back to Romans 1:18. Romans 1:18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. What was the problem in Romans 3? God had given them the oracles. And look at verse 3. We should have read one more verse in chapter 3. Let's read verse 3 in chapter 3 one more, and you'll see the connection. Verse 3 in chapter 3, for what if some did not believe? Shall their unbelief make the faith of God without effect? And now when you go, Romans 1:18 opens up that whole section with, now the wrath of God is revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. What mankind has done with a revelation from creation is the same thing Israel did with God's revelation to Israel. These are just a list of the similarities, and I had to stop here just because I filled up the slide and didn't want to start another one, but you can see so many similarities between this section and the last half of Romans 1. Look at God's truth, man's lie. Look at chapter 3 and look at verse 4. Romans 3, verse 4. We're just going to flip back the page a couple more times, and then the rest you can look at on your own. Chapter 3, verse 4. Yea, let God be true, but every man a liar. And look down at verse 7. For if the truth of God hath more abounded through my lie. You have that interplay between the truth of God and the lie of man. Look over at Romans 1:24. Romans 1:24. Wherefore God also gave them up unto uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts to dishonor their own bodies between them, who changed the truth of God into the lie. See, what he's doing here is he's showing, you know, when we were in Romans 2, we showed the inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are, that's under God's wrath if he despises God's riches for today in unbelief. And then the Jews were shown in the last half, and they were shown they weren't an exception to the inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are. They were an example of the inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are. And that's the same thing he's doing in the first half of Romans 3. He's showing them they're not an exception from the lostness of humanity described in the last half of chapter 1. They're an example of the lostness of humanity described in the last half of Romans 1. And he brings out all those things he mentions in the last half of Romans 1. He now shows where the Jews have demonstrated their own fallenness. They were given God's revelation and they rejected it in unbelief. They had God's truth and they exchanged it for man's lie. They were handed over to unrighteousness and deserving of God's wrath. Remember, Romans 1:18 starts with man's unrighteousness and worthiness of God's wrath. Let's look down at chapter 3, verse 9. What then? Are we better than they? No, in no wise, for we have both proved, both Jews and Gentiles, they are all under sin. And look at verse 24 in chapter 1. Wherefore God gave them up to their uncleanness. Look at verse 26. For this cause God gave them up unto vile affections. Look at verse 28. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them up. He handed them over. That's what we were talking about earlier. They thought they were declaring their independence and would become independent. But in declaring their independence, they didn't become independent. They were just handed over to another master. They were under sin. They were placed under sin. Look at verse 3:8, chapter 3, verse 8. Look at the end of chapter 3, verse 8, as he concludes his whole argument in the first 8 verses there. Their claim that he was saying, let us do evil, the good may come. And he concludes their damnation is just. Look at the last verse of chapter 1, verse 32. Who knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. There's just these correlations that keep going back and forth between these two things. In the last half of Romans 1, you had the separation from God. That's what we talked about a little early, and they're completely unprofitable. And that's that handing over concept that happens in the last half of Romans 1. The fear of God. They have the fear of God. We read that in Romans 3, verse 18. Look at Romans 1:28. Romans 1:28. Where in chapter 3 he says, there's no fear of God. Look at verse 28. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind. And you can just see this going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. He's bringing this back around now, and he's showing in the first half of Romans 3, he's showing that the Jews are not an exception to fallen humanity. The unbelieving Jews are example of fallen humanity. They're in the same level as the Gentiles. They're in the same wrath-worthy status. They need, as much as the Gentiles, what God is dispensing through the apostleship of Paul. So now I want to just bring that whole first three chapters together. I like to do structures. I like to kind of diagram things out. I'm a chemist, so I do a lot of diagramming, and maybe it's just in my nature. But maybe this will appeal to someone else here too. There's an actual structure in Romans. I've threw this up quickly one other time, but I just want to bring that out now and show it's a perfect structure on what I think God is doing in these first chapters of Romans. The first half of Romans 1, he's bringing out Paul's distinct apostleship and the righteousness of God. Then as we go into the last half of Romans 1, he's talking about the pattern of fallen humanity, and it's especially within regard to the Gentiles. And the first half, Romans 1, 1 to 17, let's remember that that's the pattern. Behold God's truth today. God gives Paul's ministry as a pattern for that. And to Timothy, he wrote about Paul being the pattern for how God is saving people today and how God is working today. And so the last half, we have the pattern of fallen humanity, especially with an emphasis on the Gentiles. Romans 2, the first half of Romans 2, is that his proclamation, remember he starts there, the inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are. He includes everyone, all, whosoever you are. All people, everyone, need the riches of God being dispensed through Paul's apostleship. And then we get to that pivotal, what I think is a pivotal verse in this whole section. And that is the announcement in Romans 2:16 that when the judgment comes, God will judge the secrets of men through Christ according to Paul's gospel. If you end up standing before God based on your own person and work, the only thing he's going to want to know is, what did you do with the gospel that I gave to Paul? Not because Paul's anything, but what does Paul's gospel reveal? God reveals through Paul's gospel the person and work of Christ on the cross, the good news of the cross. Now, if you think you're going to be able to stand before God based on your own person and works while having despised the person and work of Christ revealed in Paul's gospel, well, I'm just going to give you a heads up, it's not going to work. What else does Paul's gospel reveal? As we're going to see in Romans 3:21, Paul's gospel, God reveals through Paul's gospel the righteousness of God himself. If you think you're going to be able to stand before God based on your own righteousnesses while having despised the righteousness of God revealed in Paul's gospel, well, I'll just give you a heads up there. You're in strike two. You're almost out. And that's the pivotal verse, is that everything hinges on that now. Now what I'm going to suggest for the structure is it starts work going back the other way now. Now, beginning in the last half of Romans 2, he ties these two things together, where at the beginning of the chapter, he talks about everyone needing Paul's gospel, the riches of God dispensed through Paul's apostleship and message and ministry and gospel. And the last half of Romans 2, he's showing that that includes the Jews too. The Jews aren't an exception to the inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are. The Jews are an example of the inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are, who need just as much as the Gentiles the riches God is dispensing through this new and distinct apostleship of Paul. This is what we just covered today in Romans 3, 1 to 20, that first half. Now he ties that into the last half of Romans 1. The last half of Romans 1 is basically referring to general humanity as a whole, especially those Gentiles. Now in Romans 3, 1 to 20, he demonstrates that the Jews are no exception to that. They are not an exception to the pattern of fallen humanity. They're an example of fallen humanity, and the only hope is the righteousness through the personal work of Christ as revealed in Paul's gospel.